Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell, and today is episode 246 of the podcast, and I'm joined in conversation by Dr. Meg J. This is Meg's return to the podcast, and you may remember that Dr. Meg is a clinical psychologist, best-selling author, and a TED Talk phenomenon on YouTube. Last time out, we spoke about her book, The Defining Decade, and equipped you to make the most of your next 10 years. Her new book, The 20-something Treatment, is a real lifeline for a demographic who are struggling more than ever before with a number of different challenges, most notably overdiagnosis and overprescription for their mental health. This episode is very much action and value led, and you can expect to learn Meg's sage insights and advice on skills over pills, the challenges of navigating love and intimacy, how to think more introspectively, how to make real friends and deeper connections, and even how to find purpose in your career and business. Those of you that enjoyed the episode with David Robson recently on the power of the expectation effect, and in particular the nocebo effect, will be delighted to hear us talk a little bit more in depth about this one, and I fully expect you guys to keep up with that level of conversation. If you're new here, please make sure you've hit the subscribe or follow button. We've just had a record week of plays after the brilliant Rory Sutherland was on last week, and I'm very thankful to have a lot of new faces and new listeners here, and you guys continue sharing links with friends, family, colleagues who are going to enjoy these episodes. I promise you I am hurtling full speed ahead towards something special for episode 250. And as part of those 240 odd episodes so far, I'm delighted for two of them to be with the brilliant Dr. Meg J, who you're going to hear for the next hour after the music plays. Meg, welcome back to the show. We get to do this again.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Colin, always.
And we were chatting before we hit record about the beauty and the virtue of evergreen content, because you got a message from one of the listeners on LinkedIn, of all places, to say that they'd enjoyed our conversation. And one of the biggest things that I've enjoyed about podcasts over the last 4 years has been that long form evergreen nature of it, where somebody might discover it and they get in contact about the virtues and the things that they've learned from that episode. And I really, really believe that podcasts are like the new printing press from that perspective. We're creating Sure. This stuff that people continue to discover.
Yeah.
But I can only imagine it's very similar for the actual printing press, which of course is the number of books that you produce. So the number of people that maybe reach out to you about The Defining Decade, and the people that I expect down the line to be reaching out to you about your new book that you're just releasing now.
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, that's getting messages like that is why I get up and write every day, even when it's hard, because you really get the feedback that this made a difference in my life. You know, someone I've never met before and it made a difference for them. That's pretty amazing.
That positive feedback loop, and I think it comes from a really sincere place. And I think we'll probably go on to talk about social media and some of the validation that people seek online. But I think when you're creating something as pure as a book or a podcast on a topic that you really care about, the messages, they hit harder than if you're maybe seeking validation from a flex on Instagram for you on holiday, or your result from your latest fitness transformation or something like that. It's more surface level, whereas when you're creating something that you hope has a ripple positive effect, when you get those comments back, it feels even deeper.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the best part of my day for sure. And it's, and again, it's not because it's any sort of public recognition. It's the private messages, you know, about what a difference a book has made to someone. I mean, that's why, you know, I mean, I'm a therapist, and, you know, people are talking a lot more now about being in therapy or finding a therapist. And, you know, the bottom line is it's not a very scalable profession, and that good therapy is not accessible or affordable for most people. And the good news is most people don't actually need a therapist. They need better information, or, you know, good information to start with. And so that's really what, for me, books are about. And I guess for you, what podcasts are about.
Mass distribution of the most positive content we can put out there.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's great.
And that's what it opens it up to. And one of the questions early on in your book is, why now? And for me, the question, I suppose, from my perspective is, why now for this particular book? You've written so much previously, but you've been prompted to get the pen out again and go.
Yeah. Well, my previous 20-something book, The Defining Decade, even though, so I'm a clinical psychologist, I specialize in 20 somethings. I've been doing that for 25 years. But when I wrote The Defining Decade, I remember I actually had a bit in there about mental health. And my editor at the time was like, you know, I wouldn't go there. People aren't ready for that. Just let this be sort of a book any 20 something could relate to. And I said, well, I hate to break it to you, but any 20 something could relate to a conversation about mental health. He's like, okay, maybe, but it's not time. And that's another book. That's like a whole book, not a chapter. And he was right about that. And so now, you know, 10-ish years later, everybody's talking about mental health, which has its upsides and downsides. The upsides are that people are talking about mental health, and there's a lot to say, a lot to be learned about that. You know, the downsides, I think some of the conversations are better than others, and they don't all need to end with what is my diagnosis, what is my medication, etc.
I completely understand that. And I wonder, do we feel that this particular generation of 20-somethings have it harder than ever before? Because as you've said there, there's probably more diagnoses than ever before, and it seems to be like amplifying the challenges they face.
Well, I mean, that's a little difficult to tease apart in the data, because more diagnoses doesn't actually mean more disorders. It just means more diagnoses. So, you know, we know that the 20s have been a mental health low point for the 20 years I've been doing this. I mean, that surprises most people. They hear like, oh, your 20s are going to be the best years of your life. Sorry, from an empirical perspective, they actually tend to be the mental health low point of adulthood. That has been true for quite some time. I think we're talking about it more now. So people are kind of more aware of it. And they're saying like, oh, no, it's, you know, the 20 somethings right now who are struggling, when maybe supposedly they weren't 10 or 20 years ago. That's actually not correct. And I think we are more likely to end that conversation with, what's the diagnoses? What are the medications? So it's a little unclear of whether, you know, current 20 somethings are struggling more, or whether it's being talked about and diagnosed more. But regardless, it is and has been the case that the 20s are a mental health low point of life. And that's surprising to a lot of people, not to me, because I've been doing this for a while, but it is surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah, you've been at the forefront of it. And I do think terms like snowflake and soft are being thrown around more about the people that are in their 20s right now. Mm-hmm. And there is an element of, we have slightly more comfort than before. I would describe absolute poverty as like a key metric for us to look at, and it has we've definitely got less absolute poverty. So if you compare what poverty in 2024 looks like versus poverty in the 80s, the standard of living's higher. The access to food is typically higher, albeit, of course, there's going to be outliers. So we don't have some of the same worries and concerns about the very basic necessities being met. And again, somebody will be shouting down their headphones saying, yes, like, but what about this case and this case? Mm-hmm. I'm talking about in society as well. We have seen what I would call human progress across the last 20 years. And that's pretty much undeniable in the Western world anyway. But there are other problems that people are encountering which are challenging their mental health than necessarily like, do I know where the next meal is going to come from? Do I know if I'm going to have a roof over my head? Those problems are not quite as in the forefront. And I guess people are like, oh, those aren't real problems that you're facing now. And they're calling people snowflakes. And you're thinking, well, the problems may not be quite as obvious as you're stating, but they are still prevalent.
Well, yes. And I would argue that a lot of all the adults, you know, of all of adulthoods, 20-somethings are the least likely to actually know where their next meal is going to come from or what is up with the roof over their head. So it actually is a very sort of unstable, uncertain decade of life. And I think that older adults tend to look at 20-somethings and say, well, they don't have spouses, they don't have houses, they don't have kids, they don't have big careers. What could they possibly be so stressed about? When actually it's extremely stressful not to have those things, that those are adult senses of safety of like, okay, I know what's up with my job and it's going to be okay. And I know where my next meal is coming from and I can afford my rent and I know I'll be loved and I know I'll be happy. And maybe I don't want kids right now, but I know I'm going to have them. You know, that is where kind of a sense of safety comes from. And, you know, most of those adult milestones are happening later now. And so I think people look and say, well, what on earth do 20-somethings have to be stressed about? Nothing's happening, when actually it's very stressful to not have any of those things and not know if you ever will. Now, if you knew you would eventually have it, you could have tons of fun not having it before that happens. But the big stressor in your 20s, which you could probably speak to a lot, is, well, I don't know if I'll ever have that. And that's hard.
Yeah, that's huge. There's safety and reassurance and certainty. And absolutely, where there's less certainty, that's where things like anxiety, that's where like nervousness about the outcome. As you say, if I could guarantee that I'm going to meet this wonderful woman, I'm going to have this wonderful family, we're going to live in this wonderful house, and my job is going to be on this trajectory, or maybe
you
the podcast
just stop
is tipped
worrying
over,
and have a great time, right?
And just follow through. Yeah, you can just follow through on the actions that should lead you to that direction. And it's interesting, and I didn't know if we would discuss this, but I definitely like certainty. It's why I have quite well planned out days. It's why I have quite a strict exercise regime. I have quite a strict diet regime. I broadly know what my days might look like with some different variety. And I understand that about my personality. If I've done the work to be self-aware enough to lean into that.
Right.
And it's when I don't have certainty about what things might look like, and I don't have trust in the people that are deciding at that moment in time, that's when I'm more on edge. And I can completely see how somebody who maybe has things less together would be more likely to be on edge more often than I am.
Sure. Well, I mean, that is human. So humans do not like uncertainty. The brain interprets uncertainty as danger. Uncertainty makes us feel stressed and anxious. That is normal. So, I mean, that's evolutionary, that your brain is wired to keep you alive, not happy. So it's like scanning for danger all the time. So when there's uncertainty, there's a lot of danger to pick up on. And so, but you bring up an important point, which is, you can't, you know, a lot of the things that young adults are uncertain about, which is career certainty or finding a partner or will I ever have kids or will I ever have a house? I mean, a lot of those are way off. So like in terms of the data, they're more likely to happen around 30 or 35 than they are to happen around 25. So you've got years of living with like, yikes, is this ever going to happen? And one of the ways people can sort of settle down on the inside is to feel like they're building up their own skills and creating their own structure. Like you're talking about, people, a lot of people are surprised that one of the chapters in the book is how to cook. But I'm a big proponent of, if you want to remove some anxiety and stress from your life, learn how to cook. You know, it's a problem you have to solve three times a day of how am I going to eat? What am I going to have? You know, how's this going to make me feel? And that 20 somethings who do things like create a lot of structure in their day, like you're talking about, or learn how to cook, they actually end up feeling sort of more sure of themselves just on a day-to-day basis, which helps you get through to the bigger projects that, you know, you can't solve today.
When I've spoken to friends, almost exclusively male, who have had gone through troublesome periods, putting a structure together has been one of their most reliable indicators of them feeling better. Mm-hmm. Because when, and this is an interesting thing I'm talking about for probably the first time, when things look broadly the same day to day, you start to identify what some of those things in your day to day are making you feel good, bad, and different. Like you could do an energy calculator. So the gym session, you maybe color that green because you come away from it feeling great and you feel energized, or the Pilates class or the cycle, whatever it is that you're doing for your exercise.
Right.
You might find that certain tasks within your working day are red. You feel terrible. Like you hate the sales calls that you have to do, or you hate the spreadsheet admin that you have to do, and you find it really troublesome. And when day to day looks similar, you can start to see patterns on days when you feel worse because you're doing more of a particular thing. And that's when you can start to make lifestyle interventions and change these things, whether that's changing career or changing city you live in or changing the people that you spend time with or the activities that you do. Like maybe you have this cataclysmic, horrible hangover on a Sunday because guess what? Every Saturday you're going out and getting wrecked and you feel that, or you're spending time with people that they're maybe doing things that you don't feel in alignment with. You're maybe partying, you're going to places that you don't feel comfortable. And then the Sunday's a really, really hard period for you. If you're constantly doing new things and constantly seeking novelty, it's really hard to work backwards and
figure out which one is it. Yes. Well, it's interesting you say that, because that's actually a lot of what I do with people is, you know, so in the 20-something treatment, I talk a lot about, you know, skills not just pills. And I'm not for or against medication as much as for people being educated about the upsides and the downsides. And that even if you're on medication, everybody needs skills that medication cannot do at all. And so a lot of what I do with people's lives is they'll come in and they'll say, oh, I'm having a panic attack about X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, okay, well, let's get all the details. When did this happen? When did it start? What do you, you know, when do you wake up in the morning? So one example was, this was a college student, but I think many 20 somethings will relate. So a guy came in, he said, I'm having panic attacks about this assignment that I have every Friday or something. And I was like, okay, well, you know, and it was about a certain class. And so then I said, okay, well, let me ask you a really basic question. Do you go to the class? And he said, well, no, I don't, because, you know, it's early in the morning and the slides are posted and it's kind of a crappy class. I'll just teach myself. I was like, okay, well, I hear you saying that, but I also hear you saying you're having a panic attack. So like your strategy is not working. Something is wrong. And so we kind of figured out that if he got up and went to the class, okay, maybe the class is no better than him doing it himself, but it's just one more thing for him to do himself at 10 o'clock in the morning, at night. Whereas if he just got up and like got dressed, got out of his apartment, went to the class, it was, you know, admittedly so-so, but at least that was taken care of. It wasn't like one more thing for him to do at 10 o'clock at night when he has other stuff. And then believe it or not, that adjustment, he was doing better in the class, not having panic attacks about it. That oftentimes you just have to say like, what are you doing day to day? And it may be as simple as, I need you to show up for class, or I need you to play basketball instead of watch basketball. But you would be surprised if you just sort of dig through the details of people's day, you find a lot of room for intervention and improvement that doesn't have anything to do actually with therapy or medication.
Lifestyle design, I feel, is so empowering. Whereas I think when you're outsourcing how you feel to a medical intervention, I think you feel more reliant. And sure. I understand, and I think you take a really nuanced approach to it in the book when you talk about some of the pros of medication, particularly when it comes to maybe stabilizing somebody who is in just such a terrible place that they're actually a danger to themselves. Mm-hmm. But when you're reaching the stabilization period, there's an element of, right, now it's time to change your lifestyle. Now it's time mm-hmm. to build in these things that we know are probably longer term going to make us feel good. Short term, they might be a bit of a struggle, but guess what? In the pain, there's some sort of progress, and you can start to feel that a little bit of inertia that you break through. And in the way that he starts to turn up for himself early in the morning in class, that's a vote for the kind of person that has a more put together lifestyle, has a more right. put together day.
No, he said, I just feel so much better about myself. And, you know, this shouldn't be like, he shouldn't need me for that. But for whatever reason, you know, the messages are not out there in terms of what would help people. But, you know, oftentimes it's just a matter of adjusting. Because, you know, your 20s are when you're figuring out, like, how do I work? How do I deal with substances? So there's a lot of firsts, and I don't expect everybody's going to get everything right the first time. I just happen to have heard about all this many, 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 many times over a couple decades. So I have a lot of ideas about, you know, what are adjustments that people can make that, you know, don't have negative side effects and that, you know, can stay with you for life.
Given this generation of 20-somethings have more access to information than ever before, and we mentioned earlier there's been an increase in diagnoses, how do we combat that where there's almost been an overdiagnosis of particular conditions, particular disorders?
Yeah, that's a big problem. People always ask me, you know, how are 20-somethings now different than when you started? And as humans, they're not. Human beings do not change, you know, fundamentally from, you know, decade to decade. What is different, however, of course, is technology. So the information that's available, some of the, you know, bad habits around technology and, you know, the upsides too. But more and more I see people coming in and they tell me what their diagnoses are. Oh, I have anxious attachment style. Oh, I have borderline personality disorder. Oh, I have panic disorder. And I'm like, wait, hold on. No, you don't. Let's not, you know, jump to that right now, because oftentimes, you know, people don't have disorders that need to be treated. They have problems in their lives they're trying to solve. They have skills that they need. They have changes they need to make. And, you know, from a statistical perspective, they're more likely to have a life problem than to have a rare mental health problem. So, you know, one kind of very popular one right now is borderline personality disorder. That's actually quite rare. I don't know that I've ever met anyone with actual borderline personality disorder. Some of the symptoms around that are unstable emotions, unstable relationships, unstable sense of self, which basically defines being in your 20s for most people. But the DSM it doesn't take age into account. So, you know, I would be concerned about that in a 45-year-old or a 55-year-old and a 25-year-old. I'm like, well, of course your emotions are unstable. Your relationships are unstable. Your sense of self is unstable. You do not have a disorder. We just need to help you get some stability there.
I've used the term empowerment already, and I try not to use the same word lots within the podcast, but I really feel it's empowering when you understand that even if that is the diagnosis you've been given, you're not your diagnosis. You don't have to live completely in alignment with all the different symptoms and downstream effects that come with the term that you've been labeled. And I think it gives people what I would call hope for living a life that they could live. Whereas I think you can fall into despair if you do say, oh, I'm anxious attached. I'm always so needy in relationships. Okay.
Who's going to want me now? Right. Exactly. Rather than feeling like, oh, you know, so that's a big one right now is people come in and say, I have anxious attachment style. And I mean, I listen first of why they think. And then I usually am like, nope, you don't. It's not a style. It's a state. You're currently feeling worried about whether this person really likes you or whether this is going to work out or whether your friends are going to include you on a Saturday. That is extremely normal in your 20s when you're trying to figure out who your people are. But to decide that you have an anxious attachment style, like that there's something that's sort of less than ideal about you, does not help you go into the dating world or the friendship world going like, oh, you know, and I'm defective. And so there's a term called the nocebo effect, which is the opposite of the placebo effect, is the power of positive expectations. If people think they're going to get better, they're more likely to get better. And the same goes for the power of negative expectations. If people say like, oh, well, I've had this since high school, I'm going to have it forever. We could get into the weeds on which diagnoses tend to be lifelong and which don't. But most of what my clients are coming in with, situational depression, anxiety, relationship issues, et cetera, I have every confidence that these are going to get better for that person. And actually had a client recently. I saw him for a short period of time and then he was ready to go on his way, which is how I like it. And he said, what happens when people stop seeing you? And I said, well, what do you mean? And I realized he was basically saying like, are the wheels going to fall off? You know, without you, am I going to fall apart? And I said, no, I said, listen, what we've done together, you told me the problem, you told me the solution, you went out there and did it. I was just a participant, but you have everything you need to go forth and continue on with what we started. And I think giving people that hope and confidence that I believe you're probably going to get better. And I believe that you can do that.
It's really exciting, isn't it? And it's funny you mentioned the nocebo effect. I recently hosted David Robson, who's the author of The Expectation Effect. And he talked about the nocebo effect actually from antidepressants. He went through a really challenging period. And when he was prescribed a particular SSRI, the doctor said one of the side effects might be headaches and nausea. And guess
right.
what?
Right.
Immediately, he started taking them, started getting headaches and nausea.
Right.
And then but at the same time, he was researching for this book and he was like, oh my goodness, this is probably a nocebo effect.
Right.
And lo and behold, it subsided. And now he didn't continue to use the antidepressants for a long, long period. But in the duration of him using those, it was only in the first week or so that he actually had the headaches and nausea because he assumed that he would. So one way, right. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy and it didn't continue to give him those. And I think that is quite an exciting prospect. And it's good that the audience have been educated on that and they can see it in effect across multiple different conversations that we have.
Yeah. Well, and so since your audience is so knowledgeable, so we're going to get like super nuanced here. And somebody said recently, well, like, aren't you contributing to the nocebo effect by telling people that, you know, their 20s are going to be hard or that, you know, they're kind of a mental health low point? But actually, so the nocebo effect is you know, it's really about the course and the severity. If you tell somebody like, this is going to be really bad and it isn't going to get any better, that's creating like the power of negative expectations. But, you know, the 20 something treatment is really about how, hey, it's normal to struggle in your 20s and people generally get better. So, you know, I don't think you have to always say like, there's never anything bad that's ever going to happen. Don't worry, as much as to say normal, it'll get better. That's actually the power of positive expectations, that I'm not alarmed by what's going on. And I don't think that is something you're going to live with your whole life, is actually good news.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you prepare yourself for a challenging period, it doesn't mean that you expect it to be really bad. It means you expect it to be testing for you and you to come through it. Whereas, as you say, mm-hmm. if you were expecting for it to be terrible forever, then that is the nocebo effect. And it linked that whole positive expectations and understanding and thinking clearly is one of the first skills that you talk about in the book in terms of like upskilling people on how to think. And it sounds elementary, doesn't it? But just there, we've already looked at all the different nuances and ways that you can think about a diagnosis or a label mm-hmm. or a period of time in your life.
Well, right. And, you know, some psychologists would argue over the direction here, but there's no doubt that thoughts are one of, you know, in any situation, your thoughts are there in nanoseconds. I mean, you have thoughts before you even know you have thoughts. And so what those thoughts are and then what you do with them is very upstream from then how you feel and then how you act. So one of the first places, I mean, I'm always, you know, as a psychologist, you kind of have three roots in. You have thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And so you pick a root, and I'm usually sort of pulling on all those. But thoughts are pretty key. And so I'm usually looking and listening for people to tell me, well, how are you thinking about this? And, you know, like we've talked about, what's hard about your 20s? It's the most uncertain period of life. The brain does not like that. And so it tends to go negative. So when we don't know what's going to happen with our job or our relationship or our finances, the most common quote thinking error is catastrophizing. So people are like, what if no one ever loves me? What if I never find my way? What if I'm unhappy forever? That's your brain is going to do that with no assistance from you at all. It's just going to do it. So the part that where the upskilling is required, as you say, is to say, well, you know, can I move from fears to facts? Can I think less about what if and more about what is? Can I give my brain that job to say, well, let's think about this another way. What are the facts here? What do I know about this situation? Have I been here before? What does the data say? Because your brain is going to do the what-if-ing all by itself. It's up to you whether you let it hang out there forever or whether you give it something else to think about and do.
And again, it's just, it's not putting the power in your hands to decide what your brain's going to do after the stimulus comes in. So having that gap between, as you say, like we have these thoughts like within nanosections of 8 seconds immediately. But when we understand how we're wired, we can sometimes be like, okay, this has happened.
Right.
Let me pause before I react.
Right. Or, you know, okay, I just had the catastrophic thought. Let me have some other thoughts. You know, let me, you know, say, well, what else could I be saying to myself about this situation to kind of give our brain more than one way to think about something? But that takes work, practice. It also takes data points, which a lot of 20 somethings don't have yet. So I'm no longer a 20 something by quite a lot. And, you know, things happen to me that are not awesome. And my brain will immediately, you know, go negative or imagine the worst. But very quickly, I'm able to say, well, but, you know, it could be fine because of whatever, or maybe I'll get through of it because of whatever. But that's because I can easily point to worse things I got through or bigger situations that didn't turn out to be as bad as I thought. So there's a lot of data points there. And I think when you're in your 20s, one of the hard parts is you feel like there aren't a lot of data points. You know, maybe my catastrophic thoughts are actually going to come true. So it's hard, but that's, you know, these are the years you start practicing.
Yeah, and maybe we'll bemoan elements of social media later on, but I definitely feel that we stand on the shoulders of giants now. And I use that term a couple of times in the podcast because you can look at the experiences of others and see how they reacted and they responded. And we have access to the greatest thinkers, the greatest minds, the most successful people in every industry. And some people would say, oh, that's terrible because we compare ourselves to them. But sometimes I can hear how a particular person I look up to responded to a challenging mm-hmm. period. And I can be like, well, I'm going through this. and perspective is that my experience is not as bad as theirs is. And this is what they did in a more challenging situation. If I can mimic the positive traits of that, then guess what? I'm going to be fine too.
Right, right. Well, it is... I appreciate you mentioning that because, you know, social media, everything has upsides and downsides, you know, whether we're talking about medication, whether we're talking about social media. But I think I'm the last person on earth to finally join social media. And I recently just did because I, of course, am aware that it's not just where people compare themselves to other people. It's also where my age group, I mean, my people that I work with, it's where they get their information. It's where they get their news. It's where they get education. So, you know, obviously, if I want to write books and help people, it makes sense to be on those platforms and help people. And it's absolutely, it depends on what you do with it, what you spend your time looking through, I think is what makes a difference.
As somebody new to social media, and you are on there primarily as a creator, how do you find your consumption diet looks like?
Well, I mean, I have to be honest, and you know, we go way back, so I'm going to be super honest here. I have an amazing, a super awesome 20-something social media manager. So I create the content, but I actually don't, I don't really consume.
You'd be surprised how many big creators are like that, Meg, and they don't want to, they don't want to venture on there because one, it will take away their attention, but two, it might taint how they want to show up as well, because while the content that I put out and you put out is primarily positive, sometimes you reach corners of the internet that don't agree with what you've got to say.
I already know that.
And the negativity can be huge. I think TikTok in particular has been the worst for that for me, and I try not my best not to read the comments, and I try not to get involved too. And the phrase that I always stand by is, don't roll around in the mud, the pigs like it.
Right.
Because if you get in there with them and you roll about and you have a back and forth, it's not great for your
for your
energy. And sometimes you feel funny if you dunk on someone, it feels like, oh, that was funny. But at the same time, what it takes somebody to post a negative comment on social media, and maybe you've spoken to some of your patients that maybe come in and said, oh, like, I find myself saying rude stuff and lashing out on social media. It's always from a place of hurt. They're not saying it from a place of, it's not going to make them feel better. They're just trying to make you feel worse.
Right.
And the people that are showing up in the comments being negative, they're not in a good spot themselves. And sometimes you have to have empathy and pity for them to some extent.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, I had a big TED talk out. I mean, it's been a while now, like 10 years ago, but that was a very controversial TED talk. There were lovers and there were haters. And so I learned early on, because this was like right after my first book came out, that was a lot, but it was a very good crash course. And like, you can't please everyone. You can't help everyone. Not everything is for everyone. So I know there are people who don't agree with my content or maybe don't agree with your content, and like, that's okay. And it's really, in terms of social media, I think the reason I'm producing content is because, you know, I believe education is an intervention. I want to help people share what I've learned from 20 somethings all these years, but it's not really where I'm going to figure out if I'm liked or not. I feel okay about that.
Of course, you've got a level of self-assurance which I think is key. And it actually means that when you do go, if you do spend time on social media, you'll be more willing to stick to your guns and stand by your principles, because you're not seeking somebody to reinforce who you are. You already know who you are.
Yeah. And I believe in what I do, and I believe in 20 somethings. I believe in what they need, you know, that I do believe most people's, that it's a hard time and that's real and people are not snowflakes, but I also believe that most people are going to get better and feel better across adulthood. And that's super good news. And we need to be talking about that, you know, I think a lot of 20 somethings have heard, oh, these are going to be the best years of your life, and it's all downhill from there, when it's actually kind of the other way around, which is good, because that would be a huge problem if the best years of your life were in your 20s. That would be very depressing.
It's all downhill from there. Yeah. That would be horrible, wouldn't it? Yeah. I certainly agree. And in your book, you have 10 skills that you go into depth. The first one is think, but we're going to jump around a little bit just based on the time we've got together. I want to ask about how to work, because I think, as you said, and we talked about certainty, careers are less certain than ever before. And I think we're much more likely to move between vocations, whether that's industry or whether that's type of role that we do. And I think, like you say, that creates greater uncertainty. So we're a little bit more worried about it.
Yeah, careers are incredibly unstable. On average, 20-somethings will have 9 jobs by the age of 35. So there's a lot of movement there, a lot of uncertainty. That doesn't mean that everything isn't building, you know, in a good direction, but you just don't have that, you know, sort of knowing where you're going to live or where you're going to work or who your coworker is going to be. You don't really have that certainty that maybe people had, you know, 75 years ago now, but it's been a while since that's been the reality. So work is a big source of stress and uncertainty in young adults. However, it's also the leading driver of positive personality change, believe it or not. And, you know, that's because it's this thing that we do 40 hours a week and we learn a lot. And there are a lot of skills that come from being in the workplace so many hours of our day. And, you know, in general, 20-somethings are on a steep learning curve in the workplace because they haven't really worked before. And if you're not on a steep learning curve at your workplace, then I would recommend that you find another job where you will be on a steep learning curve, because, you know, that learning, those skills, the confidence, the competence, that's where a lot of that internal certainty comes from, where even though, you know, careers are uncertain, you can feel more certain of yourself. If I have skills, I have competencies, I'll get another job. I will shift to another position. I will be fine, even though things may change.
One of the concepts we went heavy on the last time we spoke was identity capital, and that's built up in the workplace a lot of the time. And mm-hmm. I think of a lot of it as transferable skills. So if I build skills presenting in my sales career, guess what? Right. I can probably go and present in some other domain, like a podcast, for example. If I build the ability in my politics degree to take vast amounts of information and distill it down into a logical argument, presenting both sides and coming to a conclusion, guess what? I can use that in so many different domains across the workplace, whether that's sales, insurance, operations, whatever you choose to do, you can use those skills that you gather. And as you say, in your 20s, you're like being paid to learn.
Yeah.
And sometimes you feel like you want to be paid more. Of course you do. But right. you're in a position where you are gathering skills and you're building up this bank of identity capital, which often you can't fiscally account for. But I really believe that it compounds. And if I look at my skill set over my 20s and now at the age of 31, I can command a really good package based on right. what I'm capable of doing.
Right.
But if I look at 25-year-old Colin, I had some elements of skill, but I've developed so much since then. And I've added to that, which means right. I start to get paid now for the work that I was doing then.
Right. Absolutely. That I do think that it's exactly what you said. 20-somethings are getting paid to learn, and they're often not getting paid as much as they could be, should be, want to be. But again, they're getting paid to learn. And so because most young workers on the job are sort of learning more than they're contributing. And that's okay. That's the way it should be. But that's really what you want, that your learning curve in your 20s predicts your earning curve in your 30s and beyond. And I'm a psychologist, so I'm not even just talking about the money. I'm also talking about earning in terms of competence, confidence, mobility, freedom, options, really for you to be able to write your own ticket.
You speak about in the book the importance of feedback and self-development within that working period. And you mentioned there about if you're not learning in your current job, then maybe you should consider moving mm-hmm. in your 20s, because if you start to stagnate, that can be quite a dangerous place to be.
Yeah, actually, I have pretty mixed feelings about working from home, and which I think I'm for it or against it. I think people need to understand the upsides and the downsides. I think working from home can be very convenient and more forgiving, and you can eat your own lunch. And, you know, there's a million great things about it. I've been sort of a hybrid worker my whole career. So I'll be the first to talk about the virtues. I do think you have to be careful as a 20-something that you're not putting yourself in a position to be learning less, you know, that I would want my 20-something self to be in the position to learn the most possible between the ages of 20 and 30. And if that meant going into an office 2 or 3 or 4 or even 5 days a week, it's worth it, because the learning curve in your 20s is going to predict what follows. And people are going to be less interested in you learning on the job in your 30s and beyond. So I think, you know, it, you know, it depends on the person and the career. But, you know, what we're hearing is that people who come into the office are more likely to get more feedback. They're more likely to be put into a variety of situations that are really going to test their skills and require that they develop others. And I'm hearing from more and more young adults that they want to go into the world. I mean, they're getting tired of being stuck in their apartments, you know, after being, you know, holed up during the pandemic. People want to be out and they want to be learning. And I think they should be.
Yeah, it's optimizing for those water cooler moments and those informal bits of feedback. I think that's really, really helpful. And I guess I'm a little bit of an outlier in that I've worked remotely for pretty much most of my career, but I've had mentors who I've spent hours with over Teams, over the phone, mm-hmm. long before it was fashionable to do so. And while I think, and this is one of the only things I remember from biology at school, is like osmosis, so like the transfer between cells. Mm-hmm. And like, I think you learn by osmosis in an office, but you also learn by osmosis from shadowing somebody in meetings. So while I was remote, I would go to meetings across the country with my mentor and my buddy, mm-hmm. and I would see how they conduct themselves. I would see the small talk they had before the pitch. I would see how they presented their slides, but I would also speak to them every day over Zoom or Teams and over the phone. I would start to learn. But then if I was working in an office, I'd be getting that access all the time as well. And I think it's so important to have somebody close to you or a group of people close to you that you can bounce off. And I do think that's being missed if you're entirely remote and you maybe don't have those formal structures to learn from. In the way that I was assigned someone that I was like, Colin, you're going to learn from Lindsay. And I learned so much from that lady. And I still speak to her even now, even though we've worked at like three different companies since then.
Right, exactly. And I mean, that's a lot to ask a 20 something, like if they're not given that structure of, hey, work that out for yourself, you know, because it's like, what? I'm supposed to like message someone and ask them to meet me on Zoom? I mean, how's that going to work? Whereas if you're in an office, you could say, hey, would you mind if I got you coffee tomorrow? I'd love to talk to you about whatever. It's
way more casual.
It's a little bit easier. So, you know, I think it's hard working from home and feeling like you're really learning as much as you could be. But, you know, I think hybrid is amazing. And, you know, going into an office 4 days and working from home on Friday, that sounds great. Or even 2 or 3 days. But, you know, I think just to put yourself on the steepest learning curve you can in your 20s is the way to go.
I think it links well to loneliness as well, because if you are working from home the whole time, and one of the skills that you really help people with is that how to befriend piece, and where we have this loneliness epidemic where we're more connected than ever online but almost more distant in terms of being able to say I've got X number of close friends. I'm sure there's this survey that people quote quite a lot where the number of Americans that were able to say they had more than one close friend is at like an all-time low. And it was actually the number of people that said zero was higher than the number of people that said one or two, which is just alarming, isn't it? And I think teaching people how to make friends is genuinely like required in this day and age.
Right. It is. And again, you know, some people would say like, what is wrong with 20 somethings that they don't know how to do this? But, you know, there's actually articles about this all the time about making friends in midlife or making friends, you know, after a divorce, like that. This is something that's going to come up again and again. And when you're in school, your friends are all around you. I mean, they're, you know, you're surrounded by people your own age, all just like a arm's length away. It's not like that. When you go into the workplace, you may be one of the few younger people, or you may be working from home, or you're scattered all around a city. So you actually have to sort of go find friends and make those friendships. And so people are like, well, how do I do that? And the data show, as does my experience, is the best way to make friends is to go live your life. So leave your apartment and go into the workplace, or go to a gym, or join a running club, or take a wine tasting class, or, you know, just get out and you do you. You don't have to do anything special to make friends. Go live your life. But there you're going to spend time with people who are interested in the same things or going through some of the same things. And that's how we connect with people. But I was on another podcast, we were talking about this, and, you know, they were referencing the fact that in the book, I talk about the research where, you know, it takes a good 100 hours to make a close friend. And think about it, when you were in school, you might spend 100 hours with someone in a month. right? Because, you know, you might spend 5 hours a day with that person and then you've got your 100 hours, you know, by the end of the month. In adulthood, it's going to take you quite some time to rack up the 100 hours. It doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. It's just a slower pace to getting to close friendship.
Great point. And you mentioned run clubs there, and I think there's been a massive rise in 2024 of them. And while I'm not a runner, I'm like really excited to see the communities, because if you go on a Sunday morning and you see these people for an hour, you run your 5K and then you have a coffee afterwards and have a chat afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's a really easy environment to say hello, because a lot of people will turn up to that themselves. And that's a fantastic thing as well. When people go to a place without an existing group or an existing click or kind of network that they've already got, you're much more open to talking to people. And I spent 2.5 weeks in Dubai in last month doing some podcasting interviews, which was great, but also networking. And almost everyone there is by themselves. Because so in a gym, if you say hello to someone, they're willing to say hello to you. Whereas if in Glasgow or in London, you say hello to someone, they're kind of like, all right, mate. Like, and not
I already have friends.
Exactly. They're not as open. Whereas in Dubai, there's the chances are they've moved there with their business or their career for financial reasons or for growth reasons. So they're much more open to networking with somebody new. And I try and like, I'm going to work on this, but like have the Dubai mindset wherever you go, in terms of like, I'm willing to make a new friend. I'm open to new connections that can work in both directions. And I think that's the beauty of things like maybe run clubs or, like, I don't want to be like pottery classes, but arts classes, something that you're interested in.
Whatever your jam is. Yeah. And I do think in the 20s, it's sort of like everybody's in Dubai, you know, that many, many people are, well, I'm in a new city. I'm in a new situation. I had a best friend, but she got a boyfriend and now I don't have her anymore. So I do think that many people are in the Dubai mindset of, I do need new friends.
But they need to be open to it, Meg. That's the key thing. Don't put your barriers up.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I think connecting through something, you know, whether it's the pottery class or the new job or whatever, you know, later it'll be, oh, we have, you know, new kids and we don't know what to do with them. You know, that's connecting through something is easier than just sort of trying to make friends.
You mentioned about your best friend getting a boyfriend. So we need to talk about how to love, because I think that's something that many of us can work on, including myself, Meg.
Okay. Well, you know, you may or may not be surprised to know that the How to Love chapter is really about how to get your heart broken because something like 96% of people in their 20s are going to get their hearts broken. And that is part of trying to learn how to love, is finding out what doesn't work or who's not right for you. And in the process, you know, people get their hearts broken. And a breakup is actually the number one precursor to depression in the 20s. So really, when we talk about depression in that circumstance, we're talking about grief, we're talking about loss. Normal to feel depressed and devastated after a breakup when someone you thought loved you turns out they don't, or they don't anymore, it's not going to work. So, you know, I really wanted to normalize that experience, that this is something difficult that a lot of 20 somethings are going to go through. And that is sort of, you know, it's kind of like the 9 jobs we talked about people have before 35. I don't know if you'll have 9 relationships and 9 heartbreaks, but you're going to have more than one relationship, and they're not all going to work out. And that's part of how you learn what you actually need more next time, or what you need less of next time. But, you know, it's normal to get your heart broken. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. It actually means that your attachment system is working.
And it's not forever as well. And one of the things she spoke about is like almost experiencing one heartbreak, but also things like infidelity or betrayal. And there's an element of, like, I try and look at it in the same way as you were discussing identity capital in the workspace. I've learned from that experience, and I now know how maybe to deal with that, or how to spot signs of it, and maybe things that should make you be like, okay, there's something wrong here, because how this person's conducting themselves is similar to how that person conducted themselves when they were about to hurt me.
Right. That, I mean, that's really, you know, it is, on the one hand, we can learn through, you know, a wise man learns from from other people, right? But so we can learn through podcasts and books and social media, and then other things you just have to learn by doing it. And so I do think the way that people find the right partner for them is probably to bump into people who are not the right partner for them. And there's, you know, probably no way around that. And it's really normal to get your heart broken and to feel like this is never going to get better, but heartbreaks do mend.
One of the interesting things I found in the, what would be called the manosphere, where like men are being encouraged to self-develop in lots of areas of life, brain, body, business, there's almost been like a free pass on how you conduct yourselves in relationships. And there's been like an encouragement of like being like promiscuous as a man, and like it being a sign of status and skill. And I find it really interesting. There's been more of a pushback on it in recent, probably months actually, rather than years, where people have been like, okay, you've been disciplined with everything apart from the thing between your legs. What's going on with that? And I really thought about that. I was like, that's really interesting, because if I talk about having discipline with my habits and my training, my nutrition, my work, my focus, but guess what? I'm going to smash Tinder to try and like try and create hookups and have these like transactional relationships. It's not aligned.
And
when I think about the times in my life when I went into that, I didn't feel an alignment either, but it was almost being normalized by the content I was consuming in terms of like how's your game, are you good at riz, are you funny, are you charismatic, are you able to like gain a sparky connection with someone. And I was thinking, oh, that's really odd, because that's not optimizing for love in the slightest. That's optimizing for like short-term gratification.
Right, absolutely. And without a sort of concern of how to treat other people, or, you know, in terms of what you're putting out there, what you're cultivating, and, you know, just the double standard of, you know, that women wouldn't get away with that.
Of course not. And that's what I find really interesting, because these guys are all too quick to use analogies like, a master key opens many locks, a shit lock or a terrible lock opens to many keys. And that terms of analogy in terms of how many, people use it when it comes to things like body count as well, which I find interesting. But when I see content like yours, which comes from a female psychologist, of course, but applies across to males and females, I think it's more helpful content for young men to read and consume than some of the stuff that's out there online that's encouraging them to create mastery in all these areas, except from one, in terms of finding a loving, stable relationship.
Well, yeah. And you know what's been interesting to me, and actually very fun and gratifying, is that, you know, across the time I've been doing this, it's, you know, from the first book, Defining Decade, this book, 20-something Treatment, over the years, I have gotten as many messages, maybe even more if I counted it up, from young males than young females. And I know when the Defining Decade was first coming out, you know, the publisher was like, oh, this, you know, it's all going to be young women reading this. And I'd never written a book before, so I was like, I don't know. But that actually wasn't the case at all. Because I think there is not enough content that's really kind of going behind closed doors with men, and that they're curious of like, what do I do? How do I have a good life? I really want to have a conversation about this. And that they're not really getting those elsewhere. So that's always, I have a soft spot in my heart for 20-something males, because I think they have a hard time of it, and they don't get as much help from society, from culture, and then they're not as likely to talk to their friends the way that young women will talk to each other.
Agreed. And you almost pair the love and the sex chapter together, because I think they're inextricably linked in some form. What do you think are the biggest lessons from that chapter in particular?
From the sex chapter or the love chapter?
Sex.
The sex chapter. So the spoiler alert for people who I know are going to rush out and read, the sex chapter is all about porn. And it's really all about how, 20 years ago, it was pretty unusual for young adults to have, you know, everybody had seen porn, but no one had seen very much of it. Now this is a routine screening question I have with people. I, you know, say, we're about to get real familiar, but, you know, how much porn are you watching? And so, you know, these days, many clients, more men than women, are like, oh man, I'm watching too much and it's not making me feel great. And so I think the biggest lesson there is, I'm not trying to talk people out of something that they're enjoying or liking, that people people are coming to me and saying, I have a problem. I'm spending more time watching people have sex than I am spending trying to go out there and meet people or create relationships or, you know, be with people myself. And it's creating this, like you said, disconnect, this terrible disconnect between what I want to be doing and what I'm actually doing. And so a lot of the work around how to have sex is, you know, well, let's get out there and try to do that rather than watching other people do it in ways that just aren't realistic. They don't really map onto what most 20-somethings actually want in their sexual relationships.
Agreed, Megan. One of the concepts you were talking about was people are using it as an education initially to like understand mm-hmm. like what does sex look like, how does it initiate, like what are some of the positions, and from that perspective, I actually think, like, as a very young man, that's actually quite helpful because it maybe reduces your anxiety about what the situation might become as when you're hooking up with a girl for the first time. But as you're saying, it now extrapolates out to somebody relying massively on consuming significant amounts of porn,
right,
and not going out there and trying to chase the real thing. Like I would call it sedation, mm-hmm, and people are. Mm-hmm. Allowing themselves to be sedated by what they get on the screen versus what they should be pursuing in real life as well. And men talk about post-nut clarity. And like after watching porn, after you've ejaculated, there's almost this like deflating feeling that like,
right.
That, well, what on earth have I done? Like, oh God, yeah. Like, that didn't feel the way it should. Whereas right. If you have sex with somebody that you love and have affection and feeling for, and you've worked hard to make that happen, there's different brain chemicals that happen at that point in time. And I think that's a really important realization for young men to not allow themselves to fall into a trap where the only thing that they're chasing is satisfaction from porn.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, the anxiety around, I mean, I think you're right in that it gives people a glimpse of like, what am I kind of supposed to do? But the best, you know, metaphor I ever heard was someone saying that, you know, learning how to have sex from porn is like learning how to drive by watching Fast and Furious movies. Like it doesn't really map on to, you know, maybe what you should be going out and trying to do, especially early on in a relationship with someone. So I think it gives people a glimpse, but, you know, the sexual scripts there are usually pretty limited. You know, it's people meet, people have sex. There's nothing about, you know, consent or safe sex or what do you like? What do I like? You know, I don't like this. Let's do that instead. That's something that you have to, you know,
there's a maturity that needs to build up. Yeah, there's a maturity that needs to build up to have conversations like that and also be brave enough to put forward maybe what you like as well.
Yeah, and the word brave, I was going to say, it takes a lot more courage to go out there and, you know, see if someone wants to kiss you than it does to stay at home and watch porn. I mean, it's
open your
a
laptop.
Lot more courage. And so, you know, we also hear more about how 20-somethings now are less likely to drink alcohol than, you know, in decades past. And I do see that, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, so I think my generation invented the drunken hookup, I'm sorry to say. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot of courage to get drunk and hook up with someone. I mean, you're drunk, so you know, your inhibitions are gone. So I think, you know, 20-somethings now, they're drinking less. They're going into their romantic relationships, you know, more mindful, more sober. It takes a lot of courage to, you know, go into a relationship intentionally and soberly in all ways. It's a lot easier to get drunk and hook up or, like you said, open the laptop.
Yeah, that's such a great point. Like I am pretty much electively sober. I drink a couple of times a year at most, depending like what the event is. And if typically outside the UK on a beach party in Dubai more recently, it was my last choice. But I definitely think there's that social lubrication piece where I was going out as an 18-year-old, I was more willing to go over and talk to the girls and have a kiss on the dance floor just because I just had a little bit of that Dutch courage would be the term. And now I'm a very self-assured individual. And if I go out with my friends and they're drinking, I'm more than happy to go and talk to new girls at the bar and hi, I'm Colin, what's your name or whatever. And it doesn't feel creepy or forced, but that's because I've built reassurance. But 20-year-old Colin is never doing that.
Yes. Liquid courage. That's what my clients call it. So, you know, I think just recognizing it does take a lot of courage to close the laptop and go out and risk that in person and try to sort of figure out like, oh, you know, how do I do this? What if somebody turns me down? What if this doesn't go well? And then you get the uncertainty and the catastrophic thinking going. But the only way to sort of build up that confidence and that being able to count on yourself is having experiences that you work it out.
Yeah. In the time we've got left, Meg, I just want to ask you quickly. We use the phrase skills, not pills. And you spoke about 10 skills within the book that people can optimize and focus on. If there was one skill that you think would be like the entry point for somebody, and like I talk about health and fitness quite often as like a gateway drug to self-development in other areas, or the pebble at the top of the avalanche towards feeling more yourself, what skill do you think somebody should maybe consider starting with to build towards?
I always get stumped on these like ending questions. So I'm not going to answer that. I will come back to that question, but I thought you were going to say like, what if I had to pick one skill that was the most important, not the starter one. So, and this one is one that I actually don't explicitly talk about how to, but it's really woven throughout the book. But if I could wave my magic wand and give all 20 somethings a skill, it would be tolerating uncertainty. That a lot of what we're talking about in terms of opening the laptop instead of trying to have a date with someone, or not making friends, or not looking for that steep learning curve at work or whatever, it's because they're having such a hard time tolerating uncertainty and just seeing the negative there. But, you know, remember, there's a lot of upside to having uncertainty in your 20s. That means a lot is still possible. A lot is still up to you. I mean, it's really kind of, I mean, I love working with 20 somethings because I can't wait to see how their lives are going to turn out in 5 or 10 or 15 years. And, you know, they're going to be somebody that they haven't imagined. They're going to partner up with someone they haven't met. I mean, there's just so much exciting stuff on the horizon. I think that if we can remember that, you know, uncertainty can be a really good thing, that that's all about possibility, that that helps, you know, people feel like, you know, not so much like they're just dragging through this sort of negative state throughout their 20s.
I actually think that's a better answer, because if somebody can master that skill in terms of being able to sit in the uncertainty and then still do the work and choose to master these other skills, that's like a foundational skill. It's like the starter point. So right. In the same way I was asking, which skill should you start with? Well, if you learn to be comfortable sitting in uncertainty, guess what? You can probably apply yourself to finding your purpose, learning how to have sex, how to find love, how to befriend, how to work. These are skills that will come down the line if you're willing to be a little bit of a novice and know that things aren't perfect right now, and they're not going to be perfect immediately, but there's areas that we can work on and start to get towards.
Right. That tolerating uncertainty rather than like avoiding it or trying to, you know, get rid of it somehow is really how you sort of lean into what's possible for you, and to, you know, kind of figuring out where you want to go next.
Yeah. There's so many temptations now for 20 somethings and so many different mediums to escape uncertainty, or what I would call discomfort, that I think that's one of the hardest things for them to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the one. If I could grant it to everyone, that would be the one.
Beautiful, Meg. Well, I've loved having you back on the show. I'm sure the listeners have loved hearing from you as well. You're now on social media. So when I ask you where they want to go to continue the conversation, where should they head towards?
It is at Dr. Meg J. It's mostly on Instagram, but you can find me on LinkedIn. I think there's a little bit going on TikTok. Like I said, I have a social media magician who's amazing and in her 20s. So I'm out there at Dr. Meg J. And then my website is megj.com.
And of course, the 20-something treatment will be available by the time this episode comes out. So all good book retailers, Amazon, et cetera, et cetera.
Everywhere, yep. It's coming out in the UK April 11th. So I hope you read it. I hope it helps.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you, Meg. And thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.